Welcome to Whistleblower Network News. I am your host, Jane Turner, FBI whistleblower and advocate. It is our honor to share with you these experiences of real-life heroes and people of integrity. We have on Austin Handel. He is the Dunwoody police whistleblower fired from the Department of Dunwoody, Georgia in 2020 due to alleged misconduct. You may know Austin, who I refer to as Captain America, if you go to the archives of Whistleblower Network News, and you'll see his story. But he has won a partial victory, and we are going to hear about that today. Welcome, Austin. It is a pleasure to have you on the program.
Oh, thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
Now, if people read that initial article on you, which was termed calling you Captain America because of your clean-cut looks, your professionalism, and your law enforcement background, they'll see that you are a dedicated law enforcement officer. But a police department out of Dunwoody, Georgia, felt that there was evidence that you should be released from that law enforcement position. Give us a little capsule of what was in that article that we wrote for WNN, and then update us on what has happened.
Sure. So in 2020, several of us from the Dunwoody Police spoke out against a corrupt command and essentially against a lieutenant that was a sexual predator. And once we spoke out very quickly thereafter, some of us had already left. But for me, I was had notified my supervisor that I was going to seek counsel and or legal counsel. And then all of a sudden, they threw me under investigation, saying I was speeding in my patrol car, but wouldn't give me the details down to exactly when or how. And then they accused me, saying that that they knew I had been speeding, and that eventually they accused me of lying. They drove to my house, took my gun and badge, and said that I lied about speeding in my patrol car, which I can say now we've seen as a theme throughout whistleblower stories in law enforcement, where they will try to go and find an employee, make them to be untruthful for something unrelated, so that way they can't testify in court as reliably later on. And so, because they'll say, oh, if this person was untruthful about this other matter, then they must not be allowed to testify about this serious matter, because obviously they're not reliable. And so it took a long time, I think, for me to understand that that's what was happening to me. But I tried to then speak out publicly about what was going on. And so I took to the news. I took to TikTok and went viral on TikTok very quickly. And ever since, it's just been a wild ride. So they came after me, continually saying I was untruthful, continually saying that I had sped and operated my vehicle in a dangerous way, and that I had been speeding through my neighborhood with my lights and sirens on, only to find out, which I'll reveal, I guess, a little bit later, but only to find out that not only was there no evidence, but even after 3 years of the city trying to file over 880 pages in the court fighting my unemployment claim, that under oath the chief admitted that it was not true, that it didn't happen, that I didn't speed in my patrol car, or that he couldn't prove it, that I didn't operate my lights and sirens in a manner that was breaking policy or local law. And that essentially it all came down to an untruthfulness claim for something that never even happened. But
that's really amazing. And Austin, could we consider that retaliation against a whistleblower?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the city spent $127,000 trying to take away my $10,000 of unemployment benefits, which it took me almost a year fighting to even get to that point where I had the $10,000. I had to go and file the claims examiner filed against me at first, because they only looked at the city's evidence. The first hearing officer ruled against me because they didn't allow me to talk about all the other stuff that was going on. They only wanted to talk about what the city alleged that I did. And then at the first level at the Board of Review, I was able to get it overturned in my favor. I wrote in my appeal to the Board of Review that it was a failure of our legal system for one government agency to immediately believe the documentation of another government agency when that same government agency is a stakeholder in the outcome of the investigation. And I think that holds true. I think that that was something that was extremely important for people to understand, was just because a police department puts it on official police letterhead doesn't make it true. And so continuing to fight, the city filed a motion for reconsideration with the Board of Review against me, and that was denied against the city. So then they spent about a year back and forth in the judicial system, filing a judicial petition over 880 pages for them to essentially allege that the Department of Labor erred by misprinting their address on one of the notices they received. The court ruled that that is accurate, that they did misprint an address, and so that wasn't fair for the city because they didn't get proper notice for one of the hearings. And the city alleged or tried to say that if they would have been present at that hearing, that they would have been able to include 63 pages of additional evidence that would have proven without a shadow of a doubt that I had lied, that I had violated policy. So they kicked it back down to the hearing officer level, went to the hearing officer level, went under oath against the chief and the people that accused me for the first time since this had happened almost 3 years later. And under that is where the chief under oath admitted that I was not speeding in my patrol car, that he has no evidence to prove that, that I did not break my brake policy and how I tested or turned on my lights or sirens in my neighborhood, and essentially boiling it down to the untruthfulness claim, or that I was, and that I was not reckless driving, but boiling it down to the untruthfulness claim, which then the hearing officer, I think, was able to pretty quickly zone in on, because even the initial things that they asked me about were not true. And when they said I didn't do the things that they accused me of, but those things never happened in that way. So I think it's been a wild, wild ride, because after the hearing officer appeal, they ruled that not only did I not knowingly break a single department policy, rule, regulation, or law, they passed it up to the Board of Review. The city filed again, asking for a appeal at the Board of Review level again, which is the highest level you can get. So it should have stopped at the Board of Review the first time. And the Board of Review returned with a twofold answer, saying that first and foremost, the city asserting that the Board of Review or the Department of Labor had erred and not reviewing all the evidence was incorrect, because they had done their due diligence, because the city asserted in twofold that it was time, it was enough was enough, and it was time for the city to receive justice from the Department of Labor, because the Department of Labor had erred by ruling in my favor for so long. And then the Board of Review, in their second part of the answer, also asserted that after reviewing all of the evidence, after reviewing the audio recordings, after reviewing the interviews and all the evidence I presented as well, that they found that I didn't break a single policy, and that the chief even admitted to that in his own testimony 3 years later. And so they ruled that, yeah, I was granted the right to have those benefits. But at this point in the process, had I have lost that final appeal, I would have had to have repaid the city $10,000. But again, the city has spent $120,000+ trying to take away my 10 grand of unemployment benefits. That is not including our active EEOC investigation, which we all still have three or four active EEOC claims. I'm unsure of the status of one of them, so I say three or four. But two of us that I know for sure actually still have active EEOC investigations after 3 years with the city. Still under investigation status. The city has spent nearly $1 million at this point defending against all of our legal claims. But this was a huge win, and it was a big step in the right direction, because in the same time as this was happening in 2022, I found out from the Georgia Peace Officer Standards and Training Council that my certification was not just reinstated, it was retroactively given back to me as though I never lost it, which is something that very rarely, if ever, happens. It's called administratively dismissing the case. When I saw that and I got the random letter in the mail after I thought that my certification was about to be revoked, I got a random letter in the mail a year later, and They said they administratively dismissed the case. I called the counsel, reached out to his secretary, and they said they had never seen that before. And so they said I had to talk to one of the directors. I talked to the director, and the director said, yeah, we went back, and I can't speak about exactly what was said or how we voted or anything, but we went back and we reviewed, and that just means that we dropped everything that Dunwoody had said that I had done. And so they gave me back my certification retroactively, so as though I had never lost it. So to this day, for those 3 years that I was terminated, my certification was in a pending weird status. I was a certified peace officer in good standing. I just didn't know it.
It's just an amazing story, and it's not over, Austin. I mean, I often say that whistleblowing is a life sentence, and your particular case demonstrates that. But in those 3 years, you have gone on to become an advocate, a whistleblower advocate. You have talked to other whistleblowers, assisted them, especially law enforcement. You're part of establishing an organization, the Lamplighter, which you're extremely important in that organization. So you really, really have made your whistleblowing advocacy well known and a part of your life at this point, correct? So I'm sorry, Austin.
No, absolutely. I just wanted to say, I think for a lot of us, it becomes part of who you are. I think truth tellers are all over the world, and I think that we wear very different clothing and very different uniforms. And I don't think that that there is a way for us to stop serving the public. I go around and I give a public speaking segment now. The last time I gave it was at the Go Heroes conference, but I give a segment called Rogue Blue Beyond the Call of Duty. And in that segment, I talk about life after service. But in that segment, I mentioned some of my story. So it also appeals to first responders that are retiring and some other stuff. But something I assert very firmly in that is that, you know, you chose to serve people long before you chose a uniform or how to do it, long before you chose a patch on your shoulder, and long before you ever chose by which term you were going to use, firefighter, soldier, or even just a police officer or a medic or a dispatcher or a nurse or a doctor. And you chose to help people because that's what you wanted to do. And long after that is taken from you, in my case, or even after that is has come to an end at the end of your career, you're still going to find yourself in roles where you're helping people. And that's exactly what happened to me, I think. I think that I wound up in a situation like where when I was 25 at the time, when all this happened, and I looked to social media, I looked to Google, I looked all over the internet for help. And there was no organization, not like the Lamplighter Project that I serve on now, that could give guidance to law enforcement officers, that could give guidance to people that were whistleblowing or had fear of just retaliation of whistleblowing in law enforcement. There was no organization to reach out to. There was no easy answer on Google for how whistleblowers and law enforcement can speak out, or what your rights even were, or how to do it, or how to go about it. And I found that it was very hard. And when I went viral on TikTok, I found very quickly I had law enforcement officers of all kinds of veterans for like 30 years to rookies of less than a year that were reaching out to me for help and guidance and also for support. And so as that was happening, I actually got in contact with someone. So Mr. Jeremiah Johnson, and also something that you had said to me just at that same time, Jane, that was, I think, pivotal for me and was life-changing. And I don't think you both realized that you had said it, was you said I had a good case. Actually, specifically, Jane, you said I think you have a dynamite case. And I still have the audio of you saying that. I edited it into a video somewhere on TikTok, I'm sure. But it was one of the most just powerful moments for me to hear that from you, I think. But also from Jeremiah. Jeremiah had reached out, and I think I'd spoken to him first. And Jeremiah listened to my story after all of his experience in law enforcement. And for me, someone that all of a sudden, after just kind of like just being in law enforcement long enough, going on to my fourth year, that just long enough that I had like that had become my identity, to have someone reach out to me that was a lieutenant when I wasn't able to like talk to my friends at the department as much anymore, like we had messages where the chief literally was telling people like if they were going to get written up if they were talking to us.
Yep.
Whether that's true or not, I don't know, but that's some of the messages we were receiving. And so we were so afraid to talk to people and even risk their careers and to seek guidance and help and information. And so when this officer that had, I don't think he was a lieutenant at the time, but he had served as an acting lieutenant at his own department in a large, large area up north, was calling this 4-year, still relatively rookie police officer in North Atlanta and telling him that, hey, after listening to his story, saying that never should have happened to you and I'm so sorry, and telling you that that you did the right thing and telling you that you were a good officer. It was so important for me, I think. And so what I started doing was that. And I kept in contact with Jeremiah. And over time, we created a support group called the Lamplighter Project, which now is a 501c3.
Yes.
A nonprofit.
Congratulations, Austin. Congratulations.
Thank you. Yes. That just happened.
Yes. And I have to say, one of those people who works closely with you at the Lamplighter Project, Sarah Thompson, is a Peace Corps whistleblower and a hero. And so that's obviously, you have a great, great organization there. We have to do a call out to Sarah because she's great.
Oh, but, absolutely. And our secretary, Norman. And I do want to add one thing, which is that what's so important, I think, about the Lamplighter Project story for me is that while I was actually on the same trip that I talked to you, I remember I was out trying to find myself. We were shooting this, some like adventure scenes for like a Rogue Blue documentary. And I pulled over on the side of the road in Utah to talk to you. And while I was later in that same trip, I was traveling to an ice cave in Alaska. I got a text message from Jeremiah that said, hey, I think maybe one day I'm going to make the Lamplighter Project into a actual organization. Would you want to be on the board one day? And I said, yes. And that was years ago now. And we've operated as a board for the past year and a half or two. But finally, after getting our 501c3 status now, we've seen it come full circle. We've seen hundreds of at least through my social media, but also through some have been channeled through the nonprofit. Some people find me and request to speak to me directly, but I try to funnel them through both, depending on what kind of circumstances about their story. But all in all, I've had 100 or so whistleblowers Amazing. That are law enforcement officers reach out to me specifically to talk to me, or reach out through the project specifically to talk to me. And just one I took last week was just from Arkansas, Northeast Arkansas. And so it's insane to be in this place now where people reach out to us after years of experience. Looking for help and guidance, because there is no system or solution that is an easy answer for a problem that runs rampant across the world.
Exactly. And I take such great pride in what you're doing, Austin, because it's so important. And you continue your service to the public. So I'm just delighted how you have, you know, helped other whistleblowers. I think this is what it's about. I want to ask you a question. You know, you were fired in retaliation for speaking up about sexual assault and misconduct perpetrated and sanctioned by senior officers within the Dunwoody Police Department. Why does it seem you mentioned about them pouring like $1 million in funds in fighting you? I fully understand that and hear you, because the FBI spent millions fighting my claim about them not dealing with sexual exploitation of children. Give us the answer, Austin, on why law enforcement simply does not just see the problem that the whistleblower brings up, rectify it, and fix it. Why are they spending millions of dollars to silence whistleblowers?
Because that would mean that they have to admit that there's a problem. And I think that there are elements within law enforcement agencies, maybe not everywhere. And I do believe that cops, by just general nature, are good people. I would say law enforcement in general, that profession, it's very hard to police the public and to be the people that that people look to for justice and for what's right and what's wrong, and to realize and admit publicly under intense scrutiny in the public right now and in the news that they're doing wrong. It also makes a very big legal argument, I think, a lot of times. Like when you start talking about sexual harassment, sexual assault, something I first said to the news back when I was very inexperienced talking to the news when I was 25 was, if this is what they were doing to us as officers, or to my colleagues, because as you know from my story, I was not in their sexual harassment ring they had going on. I just was, they tried to groom me and I didn't give in to their grooming techniques. But if this is what they were doing to us or to my colleagues, then heaven forbid what they've done to the public. And heaven forbid the sexual assault victim that's out there that wants to report to the police. And why would they feel comfortable? Why would they want to go forward? And how many cases have they erred or ruled the wrong way or made the wrong decision because of their own bias, because they also were criminals committing crimes at the time?
Exactly.
And that is really the problem, I think, is because now a lot of times there's a weighted answer there where people will be like, well, what happened was wrong. However, if we admit to what was wrong, it could release all of these people from jail. It could reverse our statements in several cases. You know, they could try to do retrials or mistrials on different issues. And I think that is something I've increasingly heard from whistleblowers that reach out to me, is that they're afraid, or they'll say, or someone in the upper command will say or tell them that they're afraid that if they actually acknowledge the problem, that it'll cause this far-reaching ripple effect throughout the criminal justice system. But it doesn't change the fact that there's a problem in the criminal justice system. It doesn't change the fact that we in law enforcement alone have to make a choice to try to fix this. And we're not doing it. And city officials will always be the first ones, or county officials, local government officials, even state officials will always be the first ones to be willing to support those leaders that are just trying to brush it under the rug, because they don't want to bring that eye onto them. Public officials have to run for election. They have to show that something we see all the time that comes in for just statistics is, like, you'll have a new police chief come in to work in an area. He'll come in, he'll change the crime or the way that they police crime almost immediately. They'll always come in and they'll say something like, oh, okay, we're going to like soften our approach on crime for a little while. And they'll do that and they won't police as much. And then all of a sudden, right when they first come in, the crime rates will spike and they'll be like, oh my God, it's so bad. And then that way, by the time that their 1 or 2 year review is up, that right around that time, they make the opposite claim. They come in and they go, hey, we need to really hit it hard. We need to hit those areas that are really having some bad violent crimes or anything like that. And all of a sudden they'll say, oh, when I started, there was a 100% spike in crime, and now look at it now, it's reduced. And it's all just politics, right?
Yes.
So
yes,
it's all
is.
Just perception.
Austin, I want to tell our audience that if they want to look at your backstory, simply go to Whistleblower Network News. You're in the archives. Interesting story, and you put up with a lot of abuse. But tell law enforcement or anyone else who's interested in either contributing or contacting the Lamplighter Project how they contact or are able to contribute to that.
So if anyone wants to reach out to us, they can go to our website, which is thelamplighterproject.org. And on our website, you'll see two types of contact forms. You'll see a business inquiry form, but you'll also see an anonymous intake form. We use a system called FlokiNet, which bounces IP addresses off of foreign servers, so that way we can't actually identify someone down to their IP address or where they're submitting from. So people a lot of times use aliases until they trust us. But you can go in there, you can say what state you work in. We won't ask anything that you don't want to tell us, but it will allow us an opportunity to speak with you, to reach out to you. And whether you create an email address or you use your own personal email address is fine. We don't publicize who we talk to, and obviously without your request, but first and foremost we will have a conversation with you. We will listen to your story. We will give not legal advice, but we will give our own experiences, and then we'll share notes and see how we can guide you forward. But the biggest thing I think success for us, at least, is that we will invite you to join our support group. So you will have so many other law enforcement officers, some people 30-year officers to brand new rookie police officers. And I'll stop to say, some of the cases I've heard are, like when I first started, was a young rookie police officer who was sexually assaulted by a detective at a police function who, when she reported it, they arrested her. Her name is Erica. They arrested her. And Erica, now she's been in the news, so I can actually say her name. Erica had fought very hard, and I'll never forget when she called me, trying to tell me her story and trying to seek help and guidance. And I pushed her to just keep fighting and to not give up. And sure enough, she was able to get them to drop, as far as I know, some of that and some of the criminal part elements of her case. And she's still fighting to this day. But a few years ago, we also gave, we gave the Lamplighter Award for Moral Courage in Law Enforcement to Sergeant Javier Escueda of the Joliet Police, who Sergeant Escueda found out that a black man had died in police custody, that there was video footage of it. And then he heard the chief tell the news and tell the family that there was no video footage of what happened. Those officers were not going to be reprimanded. And actually, and Javier tells a very, very heartfelt story and account of what happened emotionally to him. But he decided one day that he was not going to allow that. And so he went in with his GoPro and he recorded the video footage of them sticking a police baton in this man's mouth, slapping him in the face and saying obscenities at him and breathe. And he unfortunately passed away. And so he released the footage to the news and to the family. And they still they referred to him, as far as I know, as essentially a hero because he got the truth out there. But Javier Escueda is facing 20 years in federal prison. His case is still active. But those officers that did that to that man are back on the road. Mm. Javier, after 29 years of service, decided to retire early. And so I flew up to Chicago. I drove out to Joliet and I walked him out of his police department on the last day, because I will never forget, for me, like when I cleaned out my patrol car, I had family and friends supporting me, but I didn't have any other officers really, other than a supervisor who thankfully was a friend who was watching from afar. But other than that, there was no one walking with me, no other officers standing in solidarity. And I refused to allow people to feel that way. So when Javier said it was going to be his last day, flew up there, walked him out. We filmed a great TikTok video, one of the best ones I ever posted. And he looks great. And so, and it was just a big statement, I think, to make to the police chiefs. And because even the chiefs tried to come into the room and tried to say, one of the chiefs that was involved in all this tried to come in and say, oh, well, you know, hey, how are you? And tried to introduce himself to me. And Javier introduced me as the guy from the Lamplighter Project and what we do. And I got to look the man in the face as on Javier's last day. I got to look the man in the face and pretty much be like, yeah, you know, you knew we had to be here because we support ethical police officers.
Yes.
And just... And
Austin, you are just a whistleblower hero. If there's anyone in... I remember that last day being walked out. I remember it distinctly from the FBI office. If anyone is in my area here, please give me a call. I'll be glad to walk with them. And I appreciate you so much. You are a whistleblower hero. And I thank you for continuing your service to the public. Would you like to have a few last words?
Absolutely. And I'll finish with saying that if anyone that wants to see my story or watch it for my own personal story, you can do so still on TikTok. My username is officer.ash, A-S-H, which is my initials. You can watch in all these different, as the news says, bite-sized videos, but you can join our movement there. One of my hashtags I created called hashtag Rogue Blue, which is also the name of the documentary that we had been shooting, but we had to put a pause on because there is no end to the story yet.
Yes.
But also that same hashtag campaign, hashtag Rogue Blue, as of now has, I believe, 5.4 million views on it. We created this year right around National Whistleblower Day, we launched our Rogue Blue gymwear, which is a section of the proceeds go to benefiting the Lamplighter Project, but it's essentially just making a statement. Really cool. You should check it out. All that is available on my TikTok as well. So we run the shop through my TikTok page. So if anyone is interested, please feel free in supporting us and wearing some really cool, awesome logos as you go to the gym and work out and just beat corruption down.
I'll be first in line for that. Austin, thank you. And seriously, we'll be there when your end comes, whether it's 10 years from now, 20 years from now, you know how these cases go. We'll be there for you.
Absolutely. Thank you. I'll always be there for you. Thank you.
Thank you, Austin Handel.
Hey, this is Austin Handel, also known as Officer Ash on social media and as the Dunwoody Whistleblower and the Vice Chair of the Lamplighter Project. Leading whistleblower attorney Stephen Cohn's latest book, Rules for Whistleblowers, A Handbook for Doing What's Right, is the ultimate guide to blowing the whistle. Rules for Whistleblowers is an easy-to-read, essential tool for anyone curious about whistleblowing. The book lays out 35 rules to help whistleblowers navigate the complex and dangerous world of whistleblowing. Subscribers to the Whistleblower News Network can also receive 35% off a copy of this indispensable resource. Visit whistleblowersblog.org/rules for whistleblowers to learn more.
Thank you for listening, and please don't forget to like, comment, and subscribe. If you want to read more whistleblower stories, go to www.whistleblowersblog.org. Music by Rachel Kilgore. Editing and booking by Anissa Sheikh and Victoria Thompson. And a special thanks to our sponsors, Whistleblower Network News. Just as hard to stand up tall as it was when you were small. The truth is hard to say.